This is Liner Note Leftovers, your weekly musical discovery hosted by 106.1 The GOAT's resident crate digger, Dan Soul. Let's dive in.
All right, my lovelies, we are back for another Liner Note Leftovers, episode 6. Wow, 6 episodes in. That's a big milestone. Officially, Liner Note Leftovers has now run for more episodes than legendary A&E documentary show The Hasselhoffs. Feels good, man. Coming up on this week's Liner Note Leftovers, we are going to talk about how Blondie's biggest hit was originally meant for somebody else, perhaps a more famous blonde at the time. The week of this recording marked 4/20/2021. We'll get into the several rock and roll connections that has, although most of them are not true, except we'll dispel the old chestnut of, hey, if you're a stoner in a high school rock and roll band, you won't be nothing. And we're gonna play the age-old game of whose crotch is it anyways? At least on a legendary Rolling Stones album cover. All that and more coming up on Liner Note Leftovers episode 6. Let's get into it. I want you to try and combine the idea of punk rock and disco in your head. It doesn't really go together, does it? It's kind of like oil and water. If both the oil and water wanted to dunk the other party's head in the toilet. But somehow it not only happened, but also worked. On April 19th, 1980, 41 years ago, Blondie released the song Call Me, but it was never actually intended for Blondie. Because at the time, Blondie was still this sort of punk rock, new wave band coming out of when they were originally called Angel and the Snake. So they were still kind of big in the whole CBGB scene. But that said, they had already had a hit called Heart of Glass, you know that one, but they were still kind of getting known when they were working on their fourth album, Eat to the Beat. But enter into the picture Italian disco master Giorgio Moroder, who, if you don't know that name, you do remember the theme song to Midnight Express, or perhaps the classic disco anthem Donna Summer's I Feel Love, which makes my little rainbow heart sing every time I hear it, full disclosure. So Moroder reaches out to, not Blondie, but Stevie Nicks, who had just gone solo from Fleetwood Mac, and says, hey, will you do the opening score to the movie American Gigolo? I'm working on this. And originally, Stevie Nicks was actually in for this, but contractual obligations made it so that she couldn't work with him. So Moroder's left with this structure of a song called Man Machine that isn't quite there until he meets Debbie Harry, shows her a rough cut of what the movie's gonna be about, says, here, go capture this vibe of this movie about gigolos. Debbie Harry knew exactly what to do because the writing of this and the melody, she was in charge of that too, took only about 2 hours to do. Boom, boom, they take it up to New York City, and even Moroder, when he's recording this, is like, 100% we have a hit on our hands. Let's release this as a single. And a hit it was. It was Blondie's number one track, stayed there for 6 weeks before it was beat by Kenny Rogers' Lady, and is credited with taking Blondie in a whole new direction, into more this disco-y, poppy, new wave direction that gave us songs like Atomic. That ended up spawning more chart toppers like Rapture and The Tide Is High. Debbie Harry appeared on The Muppet Show to play an, albeit abridged, version of Call Me. And to this day, one of the biggest tracks of all time for Blondie. Not too bad for being the second choice on this one, hey? Will you ever picture it the same way? After you know it was the main score of a movie about gigolos? It was a hit, so maybe you already knew it. This is Blondie, Call Me. The auspicious day of 420. Everybody and their grandma knows what that term means. And just like that, everybody's got a story of where it came from. Your parents have one story, your friends have another. That dude who hangs out in the record store and his jacket smells kind of funny has another story on top of that. But let's get to the bottom of it. Where does the term 420 come from? Now, no, it is not a police code in California. That's what a lot of people believe, that 420 is the the police calling all cars. We got some guy smoking a joint. Better go put a bunch of resources into that. It's not. Never was, never will be. It also has nothing to do with the birth dates or death dates of any rock legends. Unless you count Stephen Marley, coincidentally born on 420, and is the son of Bob Marley, but that's just a weird coincidence because the term was around before he was. Okay, so does it come from the Boston song Smokin', which clocks in at 420? Not quite. Was it a secret code among Grateful Dead deadheads who are known for loving the old a little bit? They'd love to take credit for it, but they don't get it either. It's not even true, the Bob Dylan story, where the numbers in Rainy Day Women number 12 and number 35, if you do the math on that one, it does times out to 420. And it is kind of plausible, because throw stoners an apple, a Pink Floyd album, and a copy of The Wizard of Oz, and they'll find something to make out of it. So who's to say they don't have a calculator laying around? But none of these things are true. It is, in fact, that the term 420 was created by a high school band at the San Rafael High School in Northern California called The Waldos. This band discovered that they had a mutual love of the old sticky icky, so to speak, and also leaning on walls for some reason. But in the 70s, especially, you can't be smoking up in the halls. So every day, this band of youths would get together, smoke up at 420 every single day. Soon, it becomes a not-so-secret euphemism and solidly part of the lexicon. So all these other rock stars, rappers, and other performers who have used 420, they're all the copycats of some high school kids who loved burning out. So if anybody ever tells you, don't smoke or you won't be nothing, well, tell them this story. The math adds out to exactly 420 on this track. Boston's doing a little smoking. Rock star is a stressful job. And I know some people could say, oh yeah, they play to huge audiences, everybody loves them, and there's not a ton of physical labor involved with playing songs. But think about it, you got the demanding fans, you got the paparazzi, you got a touring schedule that keeps you away from everybody else for long periods of time. Sometimes you just want to get away from it all. But maybe, just maybe, tell some people where you were going, because it was April 21st, 1982, that Joe Strummer from The Clash just disappeared. Nobody knew where he went for 3 weeks. Now, eventually, he was found living on the streets of Paris. Apparently, the guy says he had a good time. He got to kick back. He got to relax. He even took part in the Paris Marathon, even though he had no running experience and his only training was drinking 10 beers a day. Guy did all right, apparently, according to the results. But what he didn't do all right was tell anybody where he was going. And The Clash had to cancel a tour because Joe Strummer was missing. They can't go on without the singer and guitarist. But why did he go missing? Why would he do it at this time? Well, it depends on who you ask. What we do know is in 1982, the recording of Combat Rock was starting to get to everybody. And so was sluggish ticket sales for the Scottish leg of their 1982 tour. So the obvious conclusion would be, okay, Joe Strummer's just majorly stressed out and he wants to just get away. Well, maybe not. Other people in The Clash have said Joe was trying to reassert dominance. Hey, you're giving me hell when we're recording this album? Hey, you're giving me hell because we can't sell tickets? See what happens when I go. Or this could have been an orchestrated plot the whole time. Because according to some accounts, Bernie Rhodes, who was The Clash's manager at the time, said, you gotta disappear. If people think you're missing in action, they'll be just so much more fond of you when we recover you that they'll be so grateful and they'll buy tickets. And it was originally planned that Strummer would go to Texas to stay with his friend and fellow musician Joe Eli. And according to some accounts on top of that, Joe Strummer was so stressed out by this fake disappearance that he disappeared for real to France, changing up the plan and even driving Bernie Rhodes nuts. Whatever happened, he was found 3 weeks later. It did nothing to help ticket sales in the slightest, obviously, and it did further tensions in the band. So much so to the point that Mick Jones is fired using the Clash communique, and for all intents and purposes, the Clash just dissolves. So what really happened? Nobody knows for sure. But personally, I think the whole conspiracy angle is a little dumb here, because if you think about it, Rock the Casbah was becoming a major hit at the time, so maybe if he just stuck it out and sold tickets, he wouldn't have to have faked his disappearance. I don't know. It's a weird one. It's something to ponder on as we listen to that track. This is Rock the Casbah. April 22nd, 1989, the day that hair metal changed forever with the drop of Guns N' Roses' Patience. While there had been hair metal ballads from time to time beforehand, every band had at least one, ranging from Cinderella to Dawkins to Poison, but once you heard that... That was Axl Rose coming through the stereo telling you, hey man, it's okay to cry. Don't worry about being sad. We get sad from time to time too, man. You sad about your girlfriend leaving you? Well, it's okay, man. Because the song, according to some people, was written by Axl Rose as a lamentation for the love of his now ex-wife, Erin Everly. However, that's never really been confirmed. And other people say that it was written by Izzy Stradlin about his ex-girlfriend, Angela McCoy. One could even make the argument that it's a love song because the music video was filmed on Valentine's Day. But there is no love in the track for Steve Adler, who, even though he appears in the somewhat understated music video for Patience, there's no drums on Patience. He wasn't doing anything. And in fact, one of the biggest times they played it live, he was in rehab, so Don Henley took the drums for him. Also, that music video, little fun fact about that, that was shot at the Ambassador Hotel for absolutely dirt cheap. Now, granted, the music video for November Rain, which is the most expensive music video to date, kind of filled the slack for that. But another weird fact about the Ambassador Hotel, it's where Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. Not sure why that was the ideal location for a love song, but if it works, it works. It was the only single released from the GNR Lies album, and it was a huge, huge hit, number 4 on the Billboard 100. A lot of people have used it as a love song, have used it as a first dance song, but the one thing you shouldn't use it for is a karaoke song, because according to Kimberly Starling of the Karaoke Informer, it's one of the top 5 songs that tends to bomb when people do karaoke of it. She in fact says, when you go out and try to sing that to your sweetheart, it eludes the average ear when you get off key, and it sounds to the ear like a turd in the punch bowl is like to hitting the eye. But I mean, is that really fair? Axl Rose is already kind of off key, and I mean, it's not like some drunk person rolling up and saying, I want to sing Total Eclipse of the Heart, or Friends in Low Places, or I want to do a duet, let's do Summer Nights. I mean, it's not that bad. Wait, those are all on the list too? Either way, not a karaoke song, debatably a love song, but it's enough that you're allowed to cry manly tears listening to it. Let's do it together right now, you and me.
Yeah, 'cause I'm missing you. I'm still alright to smile. Girl, I think about you every day.
Alright, it's time to play a fun little game called Whose Crotch Is It Anyways? The Great Mystery of the Rolling Stones' Sticky Fingers album, which dropped April 23rd, 1971. And everybody knows that this was kind of a major shift for the Rolling Stones. They were going from, they're the bad boys of rock to, this is a downright dirty, grungy album. It's got that low-down rock and roll, but they needed artwork on this album to reflect how downright grungy dirty this thing was. So, of course, we have the first use of the iconic Tongues and Lip logo, designed by John Pasch, which just exudes sex, drugs, and rock and roll. But let's talk about that cover. Now, in 1970, Andy Warhol had pitched, hey, here's what you guys should do for this album cover. Have a picture of a dude's crotch on there and have a working zipper to reveal what's underneath, so to speak. Mick Jagger really, really liked this idea, but not enough to lend his own crotch to the album cover, as has been previously rumored. Nope, that that's not Mick Jagger on there. In fact, nobody knows who that is or who the guy in his underwear is in the liner notes of the album. The editor of Warhol's Interview magazine, Glenn O'Brien, says it's him in his underwear, claiming that he knows which briefs he wore and that he got paid $100 to do it. And also he confirms it with an awkward story where Andy Warhol is taking pictures of his crotch in his underwear with a Polaroid and somebody walks in looking for an architect's office. Kind of an awkward situation to find yourself in with your pants around your ankles and Andy Warhol taking pictures of your junk. But as far as the jeans go, some people have said it's Joe D'Alessandro, who is in several of Andy Warhol's short films, including some erotic ones. And makeup artist Corey Tipton has said it was him. He says he takes one look at the bulge and says he knows his own anatomy. Nobody knows who it is. Those grainy black and white Polaroids, they make it really, really hard to tell at the end of the day. But this was an album that captivated people's attention. And part of it was due to the different variations of album covers that were out. For example, if you got an early copy of Sticky Fingers, it had a real zipper on there that you could zip up and down as much as you like and destroy your record in the meantime. Yeah, they had to recall those very quickly because scratchy, scratchy. But there are other versions out there as well. There's one that was only released in the Soviet Union, which has a USSR hammer and sickle belt buckle on it, and one that was released in Spain that couldn't have the crotch on it at all because that was deemed too offensive. But for some reason, a picture of a woman's fingers emerging from a gory can of blood was okay. Now, mostly the ones you'll find nowadays are ones that are just pictures. The zipper is drawn on. But every once in a while, man, you'll stumble across one with the actual zipper. And they don't go for cheap. The last time I saw one personally, it was in Edmonton. The zipper didn't work on it, but it was still worth $110. I'm still a little chap that I didn't buy it to this day. Because can you really put a price on the real deal, the real zipper, and the real crotch? Apparently you can. $110. But if you ever find one, you get your hands on it, because it'll be worth more in droves. Here's a raunchy little riff from that album. This is Can't You Hear Me Knockin'. Sticky Fingers, 50 years old as of this week.
Yeah, you got satin shoes.
Holy man, that's the end of another Liner Note Leftovers for another week. But I guess time flies when you're talking about American gigolos, how it's all right to cry when you listen to Guns N' Roses, and we tried to deduce the mystery of whose crotch it is on the front of the Rolling Stones' Sticky Fingers album. Short answer? Nobody knows. We didn't figure it out either. Only Andy Warhol knows, and he's not talking. I mean, we could Ouija board him, but I think he would have more issues about the state of pop art. Join us next week when we hit episode 7 of Liner Note Leftovers. Hey, who knows? We might get all the way to episode 13 very soon. And then we will have beaten the amount of episodes of the Geico Caveman TV show that they made. But one step at a time, one day we'll beat the show based on an ad premise for an insurance company. But in the meantime, keep being lovely, all my lovelies. And don't forget, always grab life and your vinyl by the edges.
That's a wrap on this week's episode. For more musical discoveries with Dan Soul, head to MyLloydMinsterNow.com or subscribe to Liner Note Leftovers wherever you get your podcast fix.